This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients every day here at the Hoffman Center. If you require a nutrition consult with me, but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.
Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin, and we're answering your questions. Radio program at AOL.com, that's the place where you send questions. And for some of you, if you sent us a question and you haven't heard the answer, perhaps you're dutifully listening to Q&A with Layla. Layla, what would you say? We're about 3 or 4 weeks behind from the time we receive a question?
I would say about three or four weeks. And the reason for that, listeners, is because you're sending us some great questions and we're getting lots of them. Do keep them coming and do wait. We will answer your question as we deem appropriate, if the question is appropriate for the program, obviously.
And I'll tell you, actually, you know, to help you out a little bit in terms of formulating your questions, questions of general interest, you know, like a specific thing about a nutrient or a specific thing about, you know, very narrowly focused question about a problem. But if you say, you know, I've got this god-awful medical problem, let me describe it. I've got this, I've got that, I've got the other thing. My blood tests, here are all my blood tests. You know, what do you think? You know, that's probably not going to make it on the air, because that is of such...
That's
the equivalent of a medical nutritional consult. And this is not just a pitch to, you know, elicit patients to become a patient, but frankly, it's beyond the scope of a podcast to delve in. You know, that would be like the case of the week, a case study, you know, where we might, you know, explore all the ramifications of a certain patient. And that's not what this is about. This is a little more of a short form answer forum where we address nutritional questions. So please do not confuse this with, you know, like an online medical office, you know, where you're going to get your entire spectrum of problems handled. I think most people, I think, have a realistic expectations, but occasionally a question will be outside the scope of what we can answer. All right. What's the next question you gave us?
We've got an email from Judy. Hi, Layla and Dr. Hoffman. Thank you for all that you do. I was wondering if someone on Coumadin were having a heart attack, would you give them an aspirin to chew on? I know both can thin your blood.
That's really a good question, and I got to say that that's a question that you know, I might ask my friendly cardiologist colleague about.
I have a question.
Yeah, sure.
Would someone on Coumadin even have a heart attack?
That's another question, because let's look at that. That occurred to me. You know, is that if your blood is sufficiently thinned, is it impossible for you to have a heart attack? Because we know that heart attacks occur when the blood clots, generally. Mm-hmm. But not all heart attacks occur because of that. Sometimes heart attacks can occur because of what's called vasospasm. In other words, you have a blood vessel that goes into spasm and restricts blood flow. And that is particularly the case when people have what is sometimes termed as an emotional heart attack, you know, where under tremendous stress, their heart literally goes into spasm. It's not that the blood is curdled or thickened and a clot forms, but there's actually the blood vessels close down. So, you know, I think that, you know, would it, there's a couple of things are involved in this question is, number one, would the aspirin in addition to the Coumadin help? And the answer is probably not, because it's a little bit like a belt and suspenders. You've already, if you're on a proper dose of Coumadin, which is not always the case. Sometimes people get, you know, off track, and that's why you have to keep measuring the INR, or the the pro time, which determines whether the Coumadin is too much or too little. And it is conceivable that one could be, you know, on too little a dose and not get adequate blood thinning, and the aspirin might confer some additional benefit in terms of thinning the blood. But this is less likely. The aspirin is less likely to help when you're already on Coumadin. And then the other question is, could it be harmful? You know, could you overly thin the blood, you know, when you take an aspirin when you're already on Coumadin?
And have a hemorrhage.
And the when this may be more applicable to a stroke, because strokes are of two kinds. They're ischemic, where there's a blood clot, and about 15% of relative minority of strokes are hemorrhagic, where there's bleeding into the brain, and therefore, you know, thinning the blood if you're having a stroke is not always a good idea. It sometimes can be a good idea. But with heart attacks, there's very little in the way of hemorrhagic heart attacks. You know, they're virtually all ischemic or vasospastic, you know, where there's some kind of spasm that prevents circulation. So I think the answer is probably not a good idea to take aspirin if you're having a heart attack while you're on Coumadin, which is less likely because you're thinning the blood already. But, you know, if you were to take aspirin, it wouldn't be horrible. You know, it doesn't make much difference, in my opinion. But that's an interesting question nonetheless. And I'll tell you, if there's anybody out there who, you know, we do have followers in the medical profession, and if there's anyone who's a cardiologist who's familiar with this type of scenario, and you have an opinion one way or another, please weigh in with a response and let us know. And on a future broadcast, we'll address it. But let's talk about this whole deal of, you know, having aspirin in your medicine cabinet or in your glove compartment. You know, in case of a heart attack. Actually, it has been shown that if you suspect you're having a heart attack, it's not a bad idea to take an aspirin, because you may limit the damage that's occurring in your heart attack. And therefore, it's a good emergency measure to take an aspirin. Now, if you're having a chest pain because you're having esophagitis or an ulcer or gastritis, taking an aspirin,
which can feel like a heart attack.
Taking an aspirin.
And that could be scary. Yes.
But taking an aspirin isn't a great idea, because it actually may increase the risk of gastrointestinal bleeding. But, you know, because I think the upside of taking an aspirin to reduce heart damage is better than the downside of maybe exacerbating an ulcer with a couple of aspirin. I guess it's okay to take an aspirin. I did get a really interesting call a couple of weeks ago on my radio program, my weekend radio program, about a guy, and he was a little long-winded because he wanted to tell me his whole medical history. And he was telling me, oh, you know, I was having some chest pain and I didn't make anything of it. And then I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, oh, it's probably nothing. It's probably stress, but we'll do a blood test. And then the doctor called me up at 10 o'clock that night. He said, you better get to the emergency room because the test results are in and it says you're having a heart attack. And it's what that bespeaks is that, number one, the guy was kind of complacent about it. He probably should have gone to the emergency room in the beginning. Number two, he went to the doctor, and the doctor said, well, you know, it sounds like you're stressed out. We'll do a blood test. The blood test, when you do it in a doctor's office, not like a blood test in an emergency room. You don't get it back in, you know, a matter of minutes. You send it to the lab. The lab, you know, processes it. Some lazy technician at night is doing the test. And all of a sudden, he sees a positive result, and he calls, you know, the doctor, wakes the doctor up. The doctor has to call the patient. By then, you know, that patient could, you know, have very, very serious heart damage, or could be dead.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, this is kind of tough to call, because the vast majority of people who check into an emergency room with chest pressure pain, it's not that. It's indigestion. It's anxiety. But,
right.
You know, if you are someone who is at risk and you're experiencing chest pain, pay attention to it. You know, at worst case scenario, you'll appear foolish, or you may incur a charge on your medical insurance. But it's worth addressing it early, because these days, you know, time is heart muscle, and the more time you waste, the more likely heart muscle will die and be irretrievably lost. And what they can do is if they catch you in this early, they call it like the magic hour, when you're either having a stroke or a heart attack, they can use clot busters, they can revascularize, they can open up circulation, and that can really mitigate the damage that's occurring. So it's important to get, you know, and hospitals are now equipped to just whip patients right into the cardiology suite so that they get these clot busters, they get stented, so that we minimize the damage.
Yeah. Yeah, I've read a few scenarios of people who would experience chest pain or pressure. They think it's gas, and they try to walk it off.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a heart attack. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I just, you know, one of my earliest experiences during my medical training was a guy who came in, he said, well, you know, my wife made me come in. He was quite jovial, really quite, quite an articulate executive and smiling and, you know, kind of apologizing. Sorry to get you guys up. And, you know, I'm having some...
My wife made me do it.
My wife made me do it. But, you know, I know this is nothing. I'm just here because my wife made me do it. And this guy ended up having a crashing heart attack. It turned into a nightmarish scenario. It just got worse and worse. And, an hour or so, he wasn't smiling anymore. He had a very, very profound heart attack, and thank goodness that he got in because he survived. And it was really a lesson learned. And this is in the 1980s, and it was the early days when they began to use the technology to open up blocked arteries. And fortunately, he was at a good hospital. I think we were at Bellevue Hospital or New York University Hospital, and they saved this guy. I think the guy would have been dead 100% if he just rolled over and said, "Look, I'm going to take some bromo seltzer," and
Oh, the number one scourge in our country: heart disease. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, Judy, thank you for that very, very thoughtful question.
Yep.
All right. We have a question here from Cindy. Cindy asks, she has two questions actually, measuring what's the right vitamin D test? Do you recommend the 1,25 dehydroxy vitamin D or the 25 hydroxy vitamin D? Because both measurements yield different results.
Yes.
Yeah, they do.
Okay, so here's how that works. Important distinction is sometimes, the doctors maybe a little less experienced or there's some confusion. The lab comes back with the wrong test. The test that you want to do is the 25-hydroxy vitamin D because a little basic physiology is that vitamin D is a prohormone, and to activate it, it's got to go through two steps. One in the liver, which is the 25 hydroxylation, and another in the kidney, which is the 1 hydroxylation. So when you get to the liver, it's going to be 25 hydroxy. And when you get past the kidneys, it's 125. So why don't you measure 125? Well, 125 is simply put, it's just not the best reflection of your stores of vitamin D. And it actually, you can get a paradoxical result. You can have an okay or high 125 vitamin D, whereas you have a low 25 hydroxy vitamin D. And there are places where 125 is valuable. Interestingly, in Crohn's disease, 125 hydroxy vitamin D, that's an example where you can have a high 125 and a low 25. High 125 is sometimes a pretty useful marker for inflammation, and it's high. So, but you need to really, most situations you really want to just do the 25 hydroxy vitamin D.
Where do we want ranges to be? Somewhere between 50 and 80.
Yeah,
I would imagine would be optimal.
Yeah, and I just saw a patient who, she's a darling patient, she has osteoporosis, and we have her on bone supportive nutrients, and she's very zealous, she doesn't miss a dose, and she was taking a bunch of supplements, which have a little vitamin D in them, and she was taking 5,000 of vitamin D in addition, and lo and behold, her vitamin D is 125. And she has had no ill effects from that. In fact, we were very happy with her bone density report. She had dramatic improvement, I think 6.5% improvement in her hips and a slight improvement in her spine. But her vitamin D is too high.
I want to mention, Dr. Hoffman, this is a woman in her 80s.
Yes.
And her osteoporosis got better. See, yeah. It is possible.
Oh, absolutely possible. No medication whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And she's a happy camper, but I told her, you better cool it on the vitamin D because you're a little high. And what could happen? She feels fine. Right. Her vitamin D on paper is high. Well, what could happen? At that level, you can have a higher risk of stones. You could have a higher risk of elevated calcium, which isn't good for the body. And so we had her cut back.
Mm. Yeah. Cindy has another part to this question. She asks, when having blood work done to take the vitamin D blood test, should I stop taking the vitamin D supplement a few days before?
No, it doesn't matter. There are fat-soluble nutrients and there are water-soluble nutrients. So vitamin C is an example of something where if you take it in the morning and you get a blood test in the afternoon, that vitamin C you took in the morning is not that likely to show up. So therefore, we suggest if people want to maintain high levels of vitamin C in their bloodstream, they should take it 3 or 4 times a day in small amounts. Vitamin D is something that lingers for a long time in the system. So it's almost equivalent if you, instead of taking, say you want to take, let's say, for example, 5,000 international units of vitamin D per week. That would be 35,000 per week. An alternative to that is to take 50,000 every 10 days. Do the math, you're going to see that's approximately the same. So you will probably see maybe just slightly lower levels of vitamin D at the end of that 10-day period than at the beginning of the 10-day period after you take your 50,000. But vitamin D kind of lingers, and you don't want to stop. Mm-hmm. It won't make a difference.
Wow.
It just won't make a difference.
Yeah.
So we have time for an additional question if it's not too long.
Ah, okay. I've got one here about sleep apnea.
Okay.
How detrimental is it to have it go untreated?
Oh, very detrimental.
Yeah.
High
blood pressure.
Yes. Yeah. Actually seen a couple of cases where we could not figure out why a person would have high blood pressure. They had none of the risk factors. They were exercising. They were on a superb diet, very, low sodium diet. And for some reason, their blood pressure was wicked high. I remember turning to one individual who I was kind of puzzled with, and he showed up with his wife, and occurred to me, I said, does he snore? And she just shook her head and she said, boy, does he snore? The walls could fall down, we did the workup for sleep apnea. It turns out he had bad sleep apnea. Sleep apnea raises blood pressure by virtue of the fact that when you deoxygenate during times where you're, you're sort of gasping, during the sleep apnea, you're deoxygenating your tissue and you're deoxygenating your heart, and what you do is you create a little ischemia in your heart. It's like almost like a mini transient heart attack, and you actually stress and damage your heart. But you also send a signal to your body to an alarm signal, which raises stress hormones, and that in turn can raise blood pressure. So it's bad. It exhausts you. It raises your cortisol. It increases your weight. It disturbs your when you have sleep deprivation. You get more insulin resistant. You become more susceptible to metabolic syndrome. It's really it's a real detriment. And you know, it's actually been shown that just by using CPAP, you know, improving breathing, you can optimize blood sugar. You can really help in a variety of ways, help the metabolism in a variety of ways.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, don't ignore the sleep apnea.
It needs to be treated. And, you know, well, let's talk briefly about, you know, okay, you can do CPAP, you can do an operation. So one operation is called somnoplasty. It's not a scalpel operation. It's sort of a, like a kind of a sound blasting, you know, ultrasound. I don't even know quite how it works, but it sort of carves away at the airway. You can do various types of dental appliances that keep the tongue from lolling back in the mouth. But ultimately, one of the best ways to deal with it is simply to lose weight. And, you know, if you've got a you know, over a 17-inch neck size, shirt size as a man, or, you know, as a woman, it's far less, you may have a crowded airway and greater risk of sleep apnea. Not always. You can have some skinny patients who have sleep apnea, too, for structural reasons. Their mouth is shaped in such a way that creates a risk for sleep apnea.
Or there's I wonder, Dr. Hoffman, what if those people with sleep apnea would sleep on something to the equivalent of a massage table, you know, where they have the opening for your face, so your face down?
I don't know. You know, maybe with your face down with, like, your CPAP feeding up through the hole, you know.
Right.
I'm not sure. You know, for some of those people, you know, positional, you know, sleeping a little propped up is better.
Yeah, if not sitting up altogether, right? But that's hard to do.
Yeah, but that's also, that's the way that people who are really obese sometimes have to sleep, because they have such pressure when they lie down. So it just losing weight is really helpful. And oh, by the way, when you get CPAP or you get correction of your sleep apnea, you lose weight, because the sleep apnea itself keeps your weight on.
Yeah, because it increases cortisol.
Increases
You're not
cortisol.
Really sleeping.
It increases and appetite.
Fat storage mode, yes.
Yep. So there is, you know, it's a bidirectional relationship between sleep apnea and weight. Weight will worsen it, and sleep apnea will worsen the weight problems. You get into a vicious cycle. That's how people go downhill fast.
Okay. So much for the quick question, huh, Dr. Hoffman?
Well, you know, it triggered a discussion. But also, you know, I think there really is something to be said. Again, you know, for patients who have sleep apnea, I think you have experience having worked at the Atkins Center, is low-carb diet can be very beneficial.
Totally. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, weight loss almost by any means, right?
Yes, indeed. All right. Just comment on, you know, one of the latest, you know, to finish the show on a final thought. They've just approved a device, a new weight loss device. It's been approved by the FDA. It's a very interesting device. Have you ever seen the way they tap maple trees? You know, they literally put a faucet into the bark, and then you turn on the tap, and then the sap or the maple syrup comes out. That's sort of what this device is. The surgeon installs kind of a tap into your abdomen, it's got a spigot, and it on the end of it, you can attach a syringe where, with negative suction, you can suck out the contents of your most recent meal. Now, some of the people in the medical profession and nutrition profession are in a tizzy about this.
That sounds like a cartoon.
It does. And it actually sounds like a surgical form of bulimia. It's sort of like, you know, the people who, you know, eat a lot.
Eat all you want, and then turn on the tap.
And then suck it out.
And suck it out.
It's, to me, it's one
of the... just terrible.
It's one of the craziest things
it's
I've ever
wrong.
Heard.
It's wrong.
It is so wrong. It is so wrong.
Oh, no.
Yeah. But, you know, somehow this gained approval. I mean, I don't quite understand how It has become, it got past the FDA, which
well,
the FDA,
you know how that got approved? Somebody paid somebody off.
You know, it just, they, look, anything that gets approved, there's a whole army of lobbyists and schmoozers and, you know, people who grease the skids. You know, just like you, when you wanted to get, you know, approval for your zoning for your new property, is that, you hire an expediter. You know, you got to hire an expediter. Somebody's on the inside who can, like, talk to the people at, you know, at the local, whatever, land bureau or the, you know, city hall to get an approval.
Town board, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well. Okay, so much for that. We could rail on for hours. Radio program at AOL.com is the place to send questions. And a reminder, please visit our store. You can access our store for via drhoffman.com or via hoffmancenter.com and find some of the great products that we talk about here on Intelligent Medicine. And thereby, you will, these podcasts are free, but you can subsidize this information source by patronizing the Hoffman Center store. You have great products, great value, and things that ordinarily you might find difficult to source. Thanks for joining us, and thank you on behalf
of
Layla.
Thank you, everybody.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.